Hello, I am Judy Calabrese. I'm a sex-positive writer, performer, and your co-host.
Hi, I'm your other co-host, Chris Medrano. I'm a sex-positive performer, writer, and musician.
We've known each other for more than 25 years, a couple for the last 10. We've been open, closed, poly, monogamous. We both have a fluid sexuality, but above all else, we are both turned on, and we want to share it.
So in the summer of 2015, we started a live show called Wet Appetites, an erotic storytelling show that brought people of all walks of life together. We wanted to create a safe space for us all to explore and expose our most vulnerable sexual selves through spoken word performance and the conversations they generated.
The shows were juicy and self-aware, erotica infused with themes of identity, authenticity, and transformation. What we created was a community, inspired and turned on and longing for more.
Before it was a live show.
It was us, in bed.
Now it's a podcast.
Welcome to Wet Appetites. Me and my orgasm found one another early in life, before we knew the difference between wrong and right. Before I knew how to regulate the temperature or the force of the bathtub faucet when I was a child. Before I knew that baseball and jerking off is for boys. Me and my orgasm didn't know one another's names. We met in the bathtub under the spout, water gushing onto the place I wasn't supposed to touch. A force moved through me like a powerful shiver. All I knew was that time and space stopped when it happened. I'd slide into a quick heat, a long, stiffening tickle. It was a magic door in the back of the closet. It was a tumble down the rabbit hole, a space all its own. But most of all, it was all mine. No one knew. No one knew I was in the driver's seat of my child's body, when everything else around me was out of my control. Me and my orgasm were always sneaky and discreet. We understood subtleties, like waiting until my siblings were absorbed in TV or my mother had started cooking. We understood instinctively how the image of myself in the mirror or the smell of me alone could ignite us. We innately understood timing and always finished just before my parents called me for dinner. Me and my orgasm danced in front of the mirror at 11 and 12 years old with new hips and boob bumps. We needed mood lighting and waited until dusk, that watery purple half-light time of day when things transform. My hips churned in circles like my Ecuadorian grandmother who taught me how to salsa. Like the wash machine, she said. Slow and sudsy, swish, swash, swish, methodical and chaotic at once. At 13, me and my orgasm chose the right first partner, a threesome. That is me, my orgasm, and John. A nice boy who popped my cherry with his fingers on my itchy bedroom rug. I would not allow us on the bed. That was going too far. He was the first person after me whom I had allowed to make me come, though I still wasn't sure what that was. I know I melted onto his fingers. I know I shed blood and immediately felt grown and shocked at the same time. John was nurturing and sweet. He cleaned us with Kleenex and held me to his chest as I shook. But it was my orgasm and I that I credit. We were the guides that took me through the uncharted territory of finding that edge where fear and electricity meet. This new place, now specific to being entered and explored. That summer on vacation in Daytona Beach, I kissed a girl for the first time. Her hands on me on the fold-out couch with my parents asleep upstairs. Her curves, touching breasts that were not mine. The unbelievable softness of her face and lips. the unmistakable sensation that I was kissing a mirror image of myself. She did not make me come, but we came close. And that experience kept me and my orgasm going all year until the following summer when I saw her again and she pretended that never happened. And I felt a gutted kind of hurt I never quite recovered from. Me and my orgasm had our first penis at 16. And because we knew each other so well, we had an unprecedented orgasmic first time, which made me rather famous amongst my girlfriends in high school. I fell in love with that boy, and I made him my first long-term co-pilot in sexual adventure. Until, after a few years, I realized he wanted to keep me. And that which felt good at first started to feel like prison. The adventure was gone. Me and my orgasm had other places to be. A few years later, my orgasm and I kept my legs crossed on the bus commute to college, an exercise in extended foreplay. It was there I found the jiggling breasts of female commuters on public transportation particularly stimulating, and I stared unapologetically, smitten with a faraway, disinterested look in women's eyes. Did they not see how beautiful they were? I began to understand men. Their unbridled lust. Upon my arrival on campus, me and my orgasm would rush to the first bathroom stall we could find and consummate our union almost daily. It was no coincidence that that was the year I discovered writing and dared to consider myself an artist. I dared to experience the world as a magical place. The more I placed that world in the hands of imagination, I began to see how one could come on so many levels. A short story, a novel, bathroom stall graffiti, the teacher's ass, the smell of wet autumn leaves mixed with coffee and paper cups, my own sweat, the smell of my scalp, the back of a poet's motorcycle, the way the red-haired woman applied lipstick in the pale pink bathroom. The boy in class with the ringlet curls and the bottom lip that hung like candy. The rush of writing a single sentence that drove me to put my hands all over myself. After college, in our temp cubicle in a Manhattan skyscraper, me and my orgasm wrote dirty post-it notes to ourselves and found empty office spaces to have daily scheduled impromptu meetings. We met late at night after bar hopping, in the backs of cabs, happy to help ourselves to a covert quickie as the city blurred by and a smile curled on my lips, hidden from the driver. Or later, in apartment hallways or in bed with the spins, wishing we'd gone home with the bartender from Live Bait or had the courage to talk to any of the girls grinding one another at the Clit Club. Me and my orgasm entertained a lot of partners through my 20s. We loved to try new things, and we had a thing for travel. Once we rode the Amtrak to Boston, hypnotized by the landscape and the adventure of going to meet a new lover, me and my orgasm found one another under my downy winter coat. We rubbed ourselves moist and writhed in our seat. My cheeks flushed and I made muffled squeaking sounds as the train rocked me towards approaching climax. As my body stiffened, I caught sight of a man on the opposite side of the car staring at me. But I was in so deep with my orgasm, he just became part of this dreamy inner chamber and I pressed on towards my destination. My mouth gaped slightly in a sort of turned-on stupor, and suddenly I noticed the man nodding no, no, no. I came so hard. And then I pretended to sleep, wanting to break my contact with him. Moments later, with my eyes closed, I felt a bulky body brush past me in the aisle, and I knew it was him. My breath became shallow, all my senses on alert. and only when I was sure he was gone, I opened my eyes. And there was a slip of paper on my lap, a note that read, "I'm sorry you feel so lonely that you have to do that by yourself. Please consider reaching out to someone for help." Me and my orgasm were on the radar. We were explosive and attracting public attention. People wanted to throw cans of shame and guilt on us. We would have to be on the lookout. This did not deter my lust for travel. My orgasm and I went around the world, coming together on airplanes, Greyhound buses, rickshaws, ferries, the passenger seat on long road trips with my leg up on the dashboard. Once even floating in a sensory deprivation tank. We had extended foreplay on scary, thrilling motorcycle rides with the brilliant poet man boy who'd only let loose on our midnight ride to the city but refused me sex. I'd return home, still vibrating, so me and my orgasm would come again and again to the smell of him and the wind on my sweater. On the ashram in Pune, India, my orgasm and I entered new territory. After being there for weeks, I'd surmised that I was somehow broken and could not learn to meditate, as I'd come there intending to do. Then late one afternoon, I tried a new meditation designed for the busy Western mind. It sounded insulting, but I was desperate. I stood with my legs apart, rooted to the floor, and shook my body for an hour to tribal drum beats. By day three, nothing was happening. I stood and shook and just felt very tired. I was just about to sit down and sulk when a sensation like a slow itch somewhere between my coccyx and pubic bone and an unscratchable itch like an electric worm was caught in my viscera. As I kept shaking, it morphed into gyrations, hips in circles. I felt my legs buckle and I struggled to remain standing. As I churned my hips, my eyes closed and a light appeared, soft but focused, and my legs suddenly grounded firmly. I found myself tunneling into that light like falling into a river of sunshine. The electric worm inside of me grew into a snake. Then it multiplied, and they slithered throughout my body and climbed upwards to the top of my head like a moving nest of eels. The light grew and grew until it took over my entire field of vision, and I started to sweat and breathe heavy, panting. I was driven to swing my hips in wild circles until my entire body was coming, like some orgasmic electrocution. Nothing was the same after that. I wanted that again and again. But even when I tried, it did not return. Me and my orgasm's relationship suffered. We didn't know how to get back there. It became an almost mythical destination. My new husband was wonderful. Our sex was good, great even, but there was no light to be found. When I became pregnant with our first child, me and my orgasm were thrilled, and our relationship became rather demanding. It took over me like hunger. I'd finish one meal and need another. Whether it was my daily swollen labia or my teeming hormones, it became my other full-time job. Big and heavy, I'd leave work early and waddle home to my vibrator, dildos, and busy fingers and try to find new positions in which to satisfy our almost abusive demands. But even pregnant and given ample opportunity to explore ourselves, me and my orgasm still didn't stumble upon that light. My orgasm and I did not accept no for an answer. Living in Amsterdam with my husband and now two children, I found myself in the middle of a marriage that was ending. As a last-ditch effort to save it, my husband and I thought we'd try opening the relationship. So, on a business trip to Paris, my orgasm and I decided to engage in a torrid love affair with a coworker. This man asked that I please keep our relationship hush-hush to our colleagues. I agreed. The last night in Paris, I knocked on his hotel room door like they do in 1950s films. He rushed me inside, poured me a drink, and then he and I consumed one another like wolves in the forest of our wildness. He had a command of my body that was unprecedented. His mouth on my pussy was like church, a holy and sacred thing designed to forgive everything. By the time we fucked, I had already come, and I ached for him to fill me. As he quickly reached for a condom and entered me and my orgasm were unstoppable. He reached that sweet spot, you know that spot? And we catapulted into what I can only describe as the cosmos. And it was there that me and my orgasm found the light. Right here in the middle of a budget hotel on the outskirts of Paris with an almost total stranger. He filled me, but that light filled me and it filled the room, and then it lifted my body. I rose until I was on the ceiling. On the ceiling of the hotel room, looking down at myself, my body, my orgasm, and this man. I think it was then that I started shrieking, not in fear, in pure bliss. Look at what me and my orgasm can do! Wow, we are superhuman. Somehow we crossed into a new dimension. The potential was now endless. But as I looked down at our two bodies, they looked awkward, confined, limited, and it seemed hilarious. I started laughing loudly and maniacally like some orgasmic hyena. Shh. I heard from below. Shh. It snapped me back into my body, grounding me suddenly. What was that? Was it the mattress? Shh. The heater? I slipped back into my roars and my belly moans as the orgasm rolled on and on. Shh. I quickly realized my lover was shushing me. Me and my orgasm. In Paris, of all places. Oh, no. No, no, no. We weren't having that at all. I waited until after me and my orgasm were completely done and fully back in our bodies and dressed before I unleashed the verbal tongue lashing. I let him have it, and that was the end of that. The next morning, I nursed my pride a little. It was difficult to separate me and my orgasm from the experience with the man, but I salvaged it. It was important to keep me and my orgasm safe, intact, and relishing the new powers we discovered together. On the train back to Amsterdam that day, sleepy and sore, the rumbling of the train under me, I remembered the incident on the Amtrak from more than 10 years before. This time I scanned the aisles, a little older, a little more cautious, before I crept back under my coat to meet my one and only lover. We would go on and on forever. Beyond the place of wrong and right.
Hi, Judy.
Hi, Chris.
So here we are. We are listening to your piece, My Orgasm and Me. And
Me and My Orgasm.
Oh, Me and My Orgasm. So we're listening to your piece, Me and My Orgasm. And first thing I wanted to ask is, what inspired this? Like
my orgasm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I realized that separate from any lovers, my orgasm and I have our own relationship. Because the orgasms are like trips, and they They're their own story. And they're mine.
Yeah.
You know, even though I always credit the lover that was there on the journey with me, but they're mine. And realizing that was really freeing and opened up a lot more possibilities.
At the beginning of the piece, you start at the beginning. You start with your childhood orgasms. Was it scary to talk about your childhood sexuality?
Yeah, because kids aren't supposed to have sexualities. I mean, it's dangerous territory. You know, I was a sexual abuse survivor. I am a sexual abuse survivor. And I always reflect on that and wonder how one informed the other. And it did. However, after years and years of therapy, I've also realized, and meditation and lots of different healing modalities, actually more than therapy, really just getting in touch with my body and my orgasms, I realized that they're also separate. That I had a childhood sexuality that was itself. Part of it was informed by being sexually molested, but part of it was literally only just mine. And so whenever I talk about it, I'm always afraid I'm giving people permission to like molest children, but that's not the case. That's not the case. It's to understand and respect that a child's body is their own. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. I mean, even as a mother, you know, those lines between you and your child are very thin often because you're taking care of them. You're taking physical care of them. But that doesn't change the fact that they own their own bodies and that they have their own sexuality. And it doesn't look like adult sexuality. It looks different and it feels different and is experienced and lived differently than adult sexuality. But it is intact in each child.
So your childhood sexuality then morphs into your teenage sexuality and your teenage relationship with your orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back while writing the piece, like what changed for you?
What changed for me between?
Between the child at the tub spout and, you know, 15-year-old.
Or even, well, that scene with John popping my cherry on my bedroom floor. I was 13. And then having like penis vagina sex for the first time at 16. What changed? Sharing that space with someone and allowing them to, giving myself permission for them to enter that space with me.
Yeah. But also, like, what in terms of like masturbation as well, I remember for me, like it not being associated with anything sexual. It was physical feeling. And then by the time we're teenagers, there are constructs that we have that interlace with the physical, you know? When was the first time you realized masturbation was sexual?
Right. You know, and that's why this piece isn't called Me and My Sex, right? Because you're right. As a child, I didn't, and I make it clear in the piece that it didn't have a name, that sensation, that place beyond wrong and right, that space down the rabbit hole, that I didn't know what it was called. It was a shiver, a sensation, a shaking, a place, an experience. You're right. That did not have a necessary connection to sexuality. Absolutely right.
Yeah.
And then separately becoming sexually attracted to people and then wanting to touch and kiss them and then finding myself back discovering orgasm and realizing that was the same thing I was doing. Yes, they were all segmented. They didn't connect necessarily until they did. And that's the thing also people don't understand about childhood sexuality. It's not they know they're sexual. It's that they're just exploring the sensual, their bodies, their relationship to their bodies. And that it is separate until they themselves connect those pieces. And it's important. And that's the important piece, to allow and respect those pieces to come together on their own for each individual. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sort of separating those things. It's really important.
Though this piece does talk about sexual relationships with others, the majority of it is masturbatory in many ways.
Yes.
Masturbation is delicious in your piece. You know, like it really, there's a gloriousness to the way you describe it. Is it so in your everyday life?
Is it delicious in my everyday life? Yeah. No.
That's interesting.
It's not. I have a very funny relationship with masturbation. I don't prefer it. It's not something I do every day. I don't prefer it, let's say, over a partner. I mean, once I found partners, I preferred another body to just going solo. But it's like exercise. You know, you always feel better afterwards.
Right.
And you know you need to do it to take care of yourself. And you're always happy that you've done it. And I hate to make it sound so banal, but sometimes it is. But other times I'm wildly inspired and go to great lengths to make elaborate setups, you know, for me and my orgasm to occur, but not always. But it's also like that in relationship with someone else, right? I mean, you have a quickie in the car, or, you know, you have a whole Saturday night with the candles lit, and, you know, it is a relationship with one's sexuality. So it can be as simple as I need to excuse myself to the bathroom at a party, or I need to fall asleep, or, you know, no one's home and I'm going to take a bath and I'm going to oil myself up and I'm going to get a mirror and I'm going to get my dildos and my vibrators and all kinds of instruments and I'm going to play.
Play, self-play. Yeah. When we get to the college years,
In the story,
mm-hmm. Your bisexuality really comes to the forefront, noticing women's breasts and then masturbating in the bathroom at school. I'm just curious, what was that like? Like, was it scary or intense? Because you could be caught.
Yeah.
You know, I don't.
Oh, that was the thrill of it. Yeah. It was college for me was. Like it was a sexual awakening. It was for many people, but it was like almost a physiological shift in my body, in my perception of myself. But it started in my body, an awakening, feeling like I was always turned on. Like it, whether it was, you know, rose petals or, you know, stepping down into the subway or, you know, the way the wind blew through the leafless trees at the end of winter or seeing someone in the bathroom apply lipstick or the jiggling breasts on the bus. It was like I felt like I was an antenna constantly being turned on by different signals. And so it was always surprising. But I started to see it almost like a video game of life. And, oh, wow, that just turned me on. And look at that. And that made my nipples erect. And, wow, like I'm doing this and I'm walking down the street. I'm thinking about a poem I want to write. And my clit is getting hard. Like it was wild. And, you know, deeply connected to the thing I was doing in college, which was, you know, learning. And I started to write, learning about things that I'd always craved learning about. I really hated high school. I hated grammar school. But when I went to college, my wings unfurled and I found my creativity. And that was directly correlated with this constant turn on feeling.
I'm going to go a little ahead. Is there a similarity between the physiological turned onness that you experienced during that college sexual awakening and pregnancy, where you're also, there's this like insatiability where masturbation comes to the forefront?
It's physiological. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, some women don't get it at all. And I totally understand that. It just was, for me, it was like I was doubly alive, you know, just from the increase in blood flow and hormonal fluctuations and the intensity of that estrogen running through you. My first child was a girl, and so I had even more estrogen running through me. It was shocking. It was shocking how much I needed, required, demanded sex all the time.
That you just made me think of something. Is there a difference between carrying a boy and carrying a girl in terms of the sexual desire?
I don't truly know. I know that, you know, my estrogen was higher when I obviously were carrying my girls. I had one girl and then another girl. However, there are 10 years between my first and my last child, my third child, which was our son. And I was 43 when I had our son, and my sex drive was also incredibly high. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know about that comparison exactly.
Okay. What's your relationship? I'm thinking about you in the bathroom, and I'm thinking about the scene on the train.
Yeah.
And with the scene on the train.
With
the guy watching. I was wondering, what's your relationship with being watched while you masturbate? Because I got the sense that in the train that you were maybe into it almost, but also maybe it was problematic.
Yeah, both. Totally. And that's my relationship with being watched. So when I saw the guy on the train watching me, every woman, no matter who you are, immediately you go on the defense. You have to make sure you're safe. Every woman goes through the same thing. I don't care what situation you're in. And you realize you're being noticed, and you're doing something sexual or even thinking something sexual, you automatically think predator. But then I did this quick math. I'm like, he's far enough away. We're on a public train. You know, there's people around us. So I was deep into feeling turned on. So I also thought, part of me thought, it's none of his fucking business what I'm doing. And then he kept looking at me, and there was like a sternness to him. And then I just felt like, fuck you. I'm going to just do what I'm going to do anyway. And then as I was approaching climax, it just became like, yeah, he's watching me. And it became part of the inner landscape of the turn on, even though he was not looking very friendly. He wasn't like giving me the eye, like, I want to be there with you. I'm attracted to you. He was just looking at me very paternalistically, honestly. And I just sort of absorbed him into whatever I was doing, wherever I was in my turn on. Yeah.
So I want to shift gears here.
And it was also creepy.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Right? I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, and it was also creepy and scary. But it was a moment where I was like, I'm in control of me here.
Oh, well, you know what? Like, you didn't expose yourself to him. You just were in his view.
Yeah, he was across the train, far enough away.
Yeah. Okay.
That, and I, as I say in the piece, I'm under my coat. Women can't expose themselves exactly. We're not men. We can't just whip out a cock.
It's just like
very different. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't summer and I could I guess, have a sundress on and spread my legs. Yeah. Plus, women don't do that.
No.
We just don't.
You're right.
For me, for cameras that men direct, maybe, but not in real life. No, yeah. It doesn't happen. Unless we're invited and it's like a co-consensual thing. No, but this wasn't that. This was me doing my thing. And Mr. thought he could
judge you.
I don't know, judge me, or maybe he was even turned on. Who knows what that note meant?
Right.
I mean,
like
reach out for someone for help. Out. Yeah, maybe reach out for me, yeah. Or maybe he was this weird preacher guy, or maybe he was trying to save me, or whatever. I don't know. I never asked. I didn't want to know.
So I wanted to switch gears to the portion in India where you first discover non-touch orgasm, in essence.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ask, had you done any Kundalini beforehand?
I had done Kundalini yoga, which is mostly postures and breathing exercises designed to raise your Kundalini energy, which is theoretically this energy that lives at the base of your spine that is essentially a sexual energy. But I just thought it was sort of philosophy. You know, it was a lovely philosophy about raising your sexual energy to up to some, you know, point of spiritual enlightenment. But I just did it because I liked yoga and it resonated with me and made me feel good. But I had no connection, zero connection to it being a sexual thing.
Hmm. Okay. So now you're in India, you're at an ashram and you're in a Kundalini.
It's a Kundalini meditation designed for the Western mind. It's sort of this easy thing to access because you stand and you shake. And so they think, all right, Westerners can do that instead of sitting still, which we find difficult, most of us. So I'm standing and I'm shaking to this tribal drum music. Yeah.
And you eventually have an orgasm.
Mm-hmm. Full body orgasm. Also, I had never had a full body orgasm before. I mean, from the tips of my toes to the top of my head, everything was tingling, turned on, racing. It was a full body orgasm.
How shocking was that?
It was a little bit terrifying. I was surrounded by people. It's a room full of about 100 people.
It almost fits into being
watched
again.
Right.
Right.
Like, but it was almost the inverse because I was like, God, someone's going to see me doing this. Right. Like, I'm supposed to be meditating. I'm not at a sex party. You know, I had never been at a sex party before at that point in my life, but I was terrified. And there was like, all my life I've had this thing where there's something wrong with me. You know, I'm too sexual. Huh. You know, why do rose petals turn me on? You know, why do the tree branches in the springtime turn me on? You know, what is this power that, I never considered myself like a sexual addict or anything. It's that sexual energy just runs so freely through me. So when I'm in this room full of people, I'm supposed to be meditating. You know, I'm supposed to be doing this thing. And instead, consciousness is connecting me with this whole other thing. And, you know, later I realized, oh, that's what they must have been talking about in yoga class. This is the Kundalini thing that takes you beyond, you know, beyond just yoga or beyond just shaking, you know, beyond even sex. And it was a cosmic connection too. There wasn't just this full body orgasm, but I had this huge smile on my face. There was this bliss that took over, this feeling of contentment, of oneness, with the room, but nobody specific, with the universe, with something greater than myself. I couldn't name, but I could feel.
And then nothing is the same afterwards.
Yeah.
So.
It's like I burst through the box of myself, you know?
What happens to your normal masturbation after this experience? Like, does that become, is that one of the reasons it's less interesting?
I think I never made that connection before, but I think that's right. It hit a wall.
I mean,
I couldn't get there by myself.
you fall in love with another meditator.
Even though I got there by myself, you know, like even though it was a room full of 100 people. But yeah, I couldn't get there just through masturbation, put it that way. And I had tried doing that same meditation at home.
The Kundalini shaking
yes.
for the Western.
Yes. I figured I got this, you know.
And you never achieved it again.
No.
When,
like
when,
to this, yeah, to this day.
So now you get married, you have children, you still haven't achieved this full body.
And the fact that's not in the story is that, you know, I met my husband-to-be at the ashram.
Right, yeah.
And even though we meditated together, it still didn't happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I have, I'm sorry, you're saying I got married, I have kids, and then what?
And throughout this, in the back of your consciousness, you must be going like, but where's that thing? Where's that thing that I had? You rediscover it.
Crazy.
During an affair.
Yeah.
Now,
technically, my husband and I had opened our relationship, and technically, I was allowed to be with this other person. But yes, you could call it an affair for sure.
I barely
knew him. I mean, it was, we'd worked together a couple of times.
And you find a full body orgasm.
A full body orgasm where I then leave my body.
Full bodied temp. What's the word? When your soul leaves your body and you, what is it? There's a specific.
Astral connection. Yeah, astral projection.
Projection. So you have a full body astral projection orgasm.
Yes.
What's going on for you
in that moment?
Because I would think for myself, I'm like, I married the wrong person or like.
For sure.
You know, like, how do you, this is really what it's about. And then like, it's a person I don't even know, like.
Who then shames me for the orgasm.
Right.
Right.
So you're like, I can't be in love, right? Because like, love also filters into mm-hmm. these things. We're taught like, wow.
If you're really in love.
I remember a specific person saying, like, talking about orgasms and being like, you don't know, your head, the top of your head to your toes is supposed to tingle. I remember vividly who said it.
Oh.
And I was like, nah, I just kind of like, I'm like gut to knees in my orgasm. And I since have experienced full body orgasms.
Oh,
but
yeah?
It's, yes. But it's been, and it, for me, it has been in love, but, and it's been with you.
Mm. How did I know that?
But for you, this first one, is this your first partnered full body orgasm?
Yes.
Yes. And it's, so what's happening for you there? Like, he shushes you afterwards
Jesus.
As well. Like,
it was shocking. The whole thing was shocking. You know, I was really, excited about the, what do you call that, clandestine nature of our relationship. Knocking on his door and sneaking in and, you know, being aware that we didn't want our colleagues to know and we're in, you know, we're on the outskirts of Paris and, you know, my husband and I are in this open relationship, but he doesn't necessarily know that I'm going to be having sex with this person. Everything with that's the secretiveness of it was itself a turn on at the time. And I do have a relationship with secretiveness and sexuality that, I have to be cautious about all the time. It's, it can get in the way with the kind of transparency I actually, need in an intimate relationship with a primary partner. But at the time, that wasn't the case. My husband had made it clear that he didn't want transparency in this open relationship. And so I was like, I didn't really, I said, well, I would really like that. And he said, no, I really wouldn't. And so I was like, great. So, because I didn't have to try very hard and I got to nurse this desire for secrecy. And so that was really built up inside of me. That is very exciting to me. And it created a pre-turn on that by the time I walked into that, his hotel room, I was already really turned on. So, you know, even after a drink, I was just one drink and I was already like just wet and ready. I knew he and I had a very potent sexual connection. Our sexual chemistry was very strong. I did not anticipate this happening. There is absolutely no reason that I can think of as to why it happened necessarily. There was no, you know, drugs. There was no magic. There was no necessary, like, you know, meditation or something that you would think like, oh, that's why someone leaves their body. I was having an orgasm that was incredible, that took over my entire body. And I cannot explain other than to say I saw myself from the ceiling on the bed with this man, and it was hilarious. It's all I looked down and I thought, what is this craziness? What are they doing? Because the experience of being on the ceiling was this larger, like I had in India, huge, connected to the universe and the cosmos and all that we are, you know, in a split second, just knowing that we are divine and connected. It has nothing to do with God or religion. It was just this oneness with everything that was quickly stopped when I heard a shh. Because that's a limit, right? So I was experiencing limitlessness, and suddenly there is a limit that every woman is very sensitive to. I mean, as children, we hear the shh constantly. And it brought me right back down. I snapped back into my body. Disappointed, but I was also recovered quickly because I thought, I'm still going to enjoy this orgasm. I'm still in this body that is having this amazing orgasm. So I was continued to growl and just roar and like, and then again, the shh. And it was then I was really clear that this man was shushing me. And again, really quickly, I have wonderful reflexes. Really quickly, just thought, I know he's not going to ruin this for me. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to see this through. I owe it to me in this orgasm to see it through, because I didn't want to look back and say, ugh, and right in the middle. It was just too good.
Yeah.
And I had a strong enough relationship with my orgasms that I knew how to honor it, you know?
So this orgasm that you have is – it's like another watershed orgasm, one that really stands out. I was wondering if you left any out.
Oh my God.
Of the piece that Dozens. Like, and if you want to tell me about one or two.
Are you fishing for a compliment?
No, I'm actually fishing. I think that like the reason we're doing this is because there's a hotness to our sexualities. All people, not me and you, just everybody. And sometimes what's for a piece that we write for the show, there are things that are left off the table that you're like, man, if that was in there, you might like have to mop the floor afterwards, you know, or whatever.
It's are you thinking hot. About something specifically?
I'm curious about like things that like when you were writing this that you were like, ooh, no, you know, like, so it is a literary thing as well. But I want to know like what was left out and can you tell me about it? Would you want to tell me about it?
I think where the piece leaves off is right before you and I got together. And when you and I got together 10 years ago, my entire sex life changed. I was able to put together all these parts that seemed disparate before that. And it revolutionized my relationship with my body, with my sexuality, with my spirituality. Because with you, I have been able to unite all of those things. And each and every time we have sex, I see that light, which is incredible to me. To be able to state that fact. It's not always suck me up like an alien light, but it's always there. And it takes my breath away every time in this really ridiculously pleasurable way. You know, whereas before I'd had, I really have a long line of really wonderful sexual partners and really pleasurable sex throughout my life with myself, with other people, men, women. But they all had, they were all, they had a finiteness to them. And there is this infinity to the sex I have with you that is unprecedented.
You start and end the piece with the Rumi.
Yeah. Poem beyond, it's the, a quote beyond that the field of
right and wrong.
I will meet you beyond, yeah, the field of wrong and right or right and wrong.
You touch.
Should probably get that quote right if you're
going to
use it.
I think we should. But we're not going to.
Okay.
You touch a little bit about shame, like pressure that's shame from the outside world in this. And I feel like the shushing.
The man on the train, the shushing.
What is shame? How does shame play a role in your orgasm?
There's this scene at the end of A Beautiful Mind, that Russell Crowe movie, where he's walking down the college steps and he's finally gotten a hold of his schizophrenia and to the point where he can like function in the world. All a roundabout way to describe the answer to what you're talking about. And he's externalized all these voices, his friend from college, this little girl, and they're trying to engage him as the voices in his head. And he says to them, you know, in short, like, not now, just I have to do this thing. And that is my relationship to shame. It follows me everywhere I go. It is always a voice in my head. It's always there, whether it's a shadow or a voice from the past or something that I hear in the world and all the messages that come in that are misogynistic and sexist and limiting and shaming. And I just say, I hear you. And now I'm going to go do this thing that I want to do. Because those voices feel bad. They feel painful and crippling. And the thing I want to do always feels good and joyful and connected. And that's the way I want to feel. But I don't ignore the shame. I hear it. And sometimes I even incorporate it into the sex and into the turn on and flip it and make it work for me. Like the guy on the train. I just absorbed him into it. And it's like, okay, I'm being watched.
So in the end, is orgasm a place beyond right and wrong for you?
It is. Exactly right.
All right. Do you have any thoughts? Is there anything you wanted to add?
I want to add that orgasm is a magic that we can all harness. It's certainly something that I cultivate actively, that sex magic is real. Because orgasm is the living force of our creative capacity, our creative potential, our pure creative energy. And we all know that thought creates form. And this is even beyond thought. This is bigger and stronger and more potent than thought. It is one's connection to one's rootedness on the planet and one's creative capacity all the way up through how we all have this creative capacity within us, and therefore we are all connected. So it's this, I see this image of this tree rooted and the root system connected to all the other trees, and then the branches that go up and reach towards the skies, And that we are all connected under the sky, and that the tree, the trunk, the actual tree body is that force of sexual energy. And that if we can get in touch with that orgasmic energy, I think we can pretty much create whatever we want.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.